Hi, I'm Derek Jensen. This is Resistance Radio on the Progressive Radio Network. My guest today is Kara Dansky. She's a feminist and an attorney. She serves on the steering committee of the U.S. chapter of the Women's Human Rights Campaign and chairs the Women's Human Rights Campaign's Committee on Law and Legislation. You can read more about her at karadansky.com. That's karadansky.com. So first off, thank you for your work in the world. And second, thank you for being on the program.
Thank you for having me.
So you, as well as being an attorney and many other things, I think you're an absolutely extraordinary writer, and you write really good essays that you put onto karadansky.com. And you wrote one, when was this? A few weeks ago, that I thought was incredibly fascinating, challenging, and just great. And the essay was called "The Gender Identity Industry is a Narcissistic Abuser," and that is certainly a provocative title. Can you tell us about that essay?
Sure. You know, I really felt like it was time to go there because it is a provocative title, and I had written a different piece shortly after the incoming Biden administration signed an executive order back in January that, just not to put too fine a point on it, would obliterate the word sex throughout federal administrative law. So I was upset about that, and I wrote a piece.
Wait. Sorry. Can you, for people who aren't up to speed on this issue or who have not heard of it, thankfully, can you just give us a little bit of a background, including what you mean by that statement? Sorry to interrupt.
That's okay. So on January 20th, President Biden signed an executive order that impacts all federal agencies. And what it does is it orders all federal agencies to redefine the word sex to include the phrase gender identity throughout federal administrative law. And from a feminist perspective, that's extremely dangerous because women have been excluded from and discriminated against throughout all of society for thousands of years globally, specifically on the basis of our sex. And feminists have made some really remarkable strides in protecting women and girls in the law on the basis of sex and sort of redefining that word to include the very amorphous and undefined and frankly undefinable concept of gender identity is really bad if one of your goals in life is protecting women and girls on the basis of sex.
So can we give a couple examples of what you mean, like women's shelter or sports? What does this mean?
So we know that in your state of California, between January and March of this year, there were 261 applications to the California Department of Corrections and Rehabilitation to transfer violent male prisoners into women's prisons on the basis of their so-called gender identity, whatever that may mean. These prisoners claim to have a gender identity of woman, notwithstanding the fact that woman is actually a biological category. So that's happening. Also on the prison issue, I believe at this time it has been documented that there are 8 male prisoners in the state of Washington who are being held in the women's prison on the basis of their so-called gender identity, one of whom had been convicted of murder. I believe his murder victim was a prostituted woman, and another of whom had been convicted of raping a 12-year-old girl. And the state of Washington, for some reason, thinks that it is a good idea to house these male prisoners who have been convicted of things like murder and rape in a female prison on the basis of their so-called gender identity.
So the prison. You may not know the answer to this one, but is Douglas/Donna Perry included in those ones who are held in women's prisons? He's a serial killer of women.
I think I've seen that name, but I don't want to say for sure.
Okay, sorry, go ahead.
That's okay. Other areas where we're seeing this play out include, for example, public restrooms. So where I live in Washington, D.C., there is an ordinance on the books that says that anyone can use a public restroom that aligns with their so-called gender identity. And, you know, a very practical result of that is that one time I was in a neighborhood restaurant before COVID, and I walked into the women's bathroom, and there was a man in there wearing a long dress and a long blonde wig, and had some more trappings of sort of what we might refer to as patriarchal notions of femininity. And there was nothing I could do about it. That's not entirely true. There was nothing I could do about it because I knew the owner, and I was able to say to the owner, and this sort of goes to the theme that we're talking about today. I said to the owner, who was a friend, I said, I cannot socially say this to you, and there's nothing you can legally do about it, but there is currently a man in the women's bathroom. And the fact that, you know, he's legally prohibited from doing anything about it, and he knows that, and I know that, but the fact that I had to preface that statement by saying, what I'm about to say is not socially acceptable, kind of gets at one of the more manipulative and really oppressive ways in which what I am referring to is the gender identity industry has gone about doing what it's been doing. And as you mentioned, domestic violence shelters are another area. One of the more famous examples possibly is Vancouver Rape Relief, which lost a lot of its funding because it held firm to its policy of allowing only women to reside there. That's one of the more famous examples globally, but we know that there are many examples of the same thing happening throughout the U.S., including, I'm pretty sure, one instance that took place in an Oregon domestic violence shelter. So what it means is that women are simply no longer socially or legally permitted to have female-only spaces.
And before there's one more background question I want to ask before we move on to your fabulous essay, which is, can you talk just a little bit about why women's only spaces are important and the struggle? I mean, we always hear they just want to pee, but right. Can you talk about the struggle for women's only spaces and women's only bathrooms? 'Cause sometimes the bathroom issue is really dismissed, which really bothers me. Anyway, so can you talk about women's struggles for that and why that's important?
Sure. So women fought very hard to have women-only bathrooms because before we had them, if women wanted to be out and about in society, they had to use the bathroom with men. And they didn't want to do that, in part just because it's embarrassing and weird, and in part because we know that the overwhelming majority of violent crime is committed by male people, regardless of identity. You know, we know that to be true. And so for women to have to share vulnerable spaces like public bathrooms where, you know, lots of things go on, it's not just about peeing. Women have a lot of experiences in the bathroom that we don't necessarily want to share with men. We also really very much don't want to be assaulted or raped or murdered in a public bathroom or anywhere else. And so women-only spaces are a refuge where we can get away from men.
The same with colleges, classes, etc.
Sure. Dormitories. My understanding of the current state of things with respect to dormitories is that if you send your 18-year-old daughter off to college, you have no guarantee that your daughter will be housed in a dorm room with a female roommate. Further, you're not allowed to ask as a parent. You are not permitted to ask a college administration if your daughter is being housed in a dormitory with a male or female roommate.
So this does, let's move to your essay.
Well, just before we do that.
Great.
So I understand that the things that I'm saying sound crazy. And the reason that they sound crazy is that they are crazy. But I guarantee you, this is the state of things. And I know you know this. But this is the state of things in the United States and globally today. But part of the reason that the feminist movement is having trouble being heard, there are many reasons, but part of the reason is that the things that I'm saying sound so crazy that nobody believes us. Nobody wants to believe that male prisoners who have been convicted of murdering prostituted women or raping 12-year-old girls are being housed in women's prison. And I understand why nobody wants to believe that, because that's a very uncomfortable reality. Unfortunately, it's completely true.
Well, we have Karen White in the UK, who was he's a man, and he was convicted of rape on the streets of multiple women, and has been housed in a women's prison in the UK where he has raped multiple women.
Yes, and a similar allegation has come forward in the state of Washington and the state of Illinois, where two women, whose names I don't know, have stated that they have been raped in prison by men who claim a quote-unquote female gender identity.
And also, you know, I used to teach at a men's prison, and I've known a fair number of women who have been in prison, and some of the women who were in prison had been abused on the streets, or abused out in public. I mean, out in the real world, outside prison. And for some of the women who had been severely abused, their time in prison was horrible, as all prison time is, but at the same time, it was a bit of a respite from the abuse that they had suffered.
Yeah.
Okay, sorry. So go ahead.
That's okay. No, that was really all I wanted to say. It's just that if your listeners are thinking that the things that I am saying sound crazy, it is because that they're right, because these things are crazy, but nonetheless, they are happening. And as our mutual friend Lierre Keith often says, and she's totally right, the worst part of all of this is that no one believes us.
So that no one believing us, so I'm going to go off on my own tangent that, you know, I've written extensively about the abuse that my family went through as a child. And one of the things that was absolutely standard at that point was that nobody believed us. You know, we could tell people at school or we could tell people at church and nobody believed any of it. So which takes us, I'm incredibly fascinated by the interplay between abusive dynamics and how they can play out on a social level.
Mm-hmm.
Which is one of the reasons I loved your essay so much. So let's talk about your essay.
Sure. So it kind of begins with a little bit about my own story of waking up at the end of a 10-year relationship to understanding that, in fact, it was abusive. I didn't understand that for the longest time. And I should maybe also just back up and say part of what clicked here and why I really wanted to write this is that so many people in our society do not understand that what they are experiencing is abuse. And that's a perfectly understandable thing. Having been there myself, I just didn't get it. I didn't have knowledge or vocabulary that many of us have today around things like gaslighting. And I go into this a little bit in the piece. I just didn't know that psychological abuse was a thing. And it wasn't even until it started to get physical that I woke up and I thought, okay, something is really wrong here. And I started looking into it. And the more I looked into it, the more it was clear to me that what was happening to me was sort of a textbook, a textbook example of the abusive tactics that narcissists and manipulators will use to make their victims think that they're crazy. Right. So once I started really thinking deeply about that, I mean, I've been out of this relationship for years, so that's all good. But I often get the question, Kara, why is this happening? we can all see plainly that this is ridiculous. So why is society doing this? And I really thought about that. I really challenged myself to come up with some helpful reasons why this is happening. And I realized that part of the reason that people don't know that they're being abused is the same reason that I didn't know that I was being abused, because it's so hard to acknowledge that that is what is going on. So that's kind of where the essay starts. It kind of starts out by saying, okay, I went through this in my personal relationship of waking up to the reality of abuse. And it seems to me that if we're going to get anywhere pushing back against the gender identity industry, we have to acknowledge that there are some really understandable reasons why people are still not waking up. And so I kind of wanted to explore that nexus in the essay.
I just want to give an example of how we have to all pretend that the absurd is reasonable, and that would be sports. I mean, all the stuff you've said before is so true, but you know, there are 300, I believe, high school boys in the United States alone who can run faster than the fastest woman in the world. And what was it? A boys' high school team beat the women's national soccer team. And I was a decent high jumper in college. I won my small college conference championship, but it was Division II. So I was pretty good, but I never qualified even for Division II nationals, or certainly not Division I nationals. But I would have held the women's high jump world record. And to this day, I would be within a quarter inch of the women's high jump record. It's just manifestly absurd to compare to. And we have examples of what the guy who was the 350th best hurdler in the Division II nation and identifies as a woman and became the national champion. And I mean, there's just example after example of this. And yet we're all supposed to go along and hear these just self-evident absurdities get trotted out as though there is a basis for them.
Well, here's the thing. Those absurdities don't get trotted out using the language that you used, right? One of the reasons that this has been so effective and that sort of average, regular people can be persuaded that it's okay is the use of probably my least favorite word in the history of knowing words, which is the word transgender. It ruins everything, because what people will say, people who want to justify allowing men to compete in women's sports won't say that. They won't just be honest about it. They'll say, you know, we need to let trans women, and you can imagine my air quotes right now, participate in women's sports because, quote unquote, trans women are women. So it's constantly being framed as a discussion about transgender athletes' right to be included versus women's rights to compete with and against exclusively women. And as long as that framing is permitted to persist, we're just going to have to keep having this discussion, because proponents of allowing men to compete in women's sports don't ever say that. That's part of why what you just said, that we shouldn't let men compete in women's sports, does seem patently obvious to most people, and most people will agree with it. But when you sneak in transgender athletes, then our arguments sort of carry less power, because transgender is allegedly some sort of, you know, it's trotted out as some sort of coherent category of people, but it's not. Does that make sense?
Yeah, it makes perfect sense. And while I'm really enjoying this conversation, I'm feeling like I'm taking us away from your great essay. So can you please put us back on the path?
Sure. So the essay kind of starts out talking about the painfulness of waking up to the realization that we're in an abusive relationship. And, you know, I have a little paragraph where I talk about, and this totally happened, I was driving from Ohio to DC, And I thought, you know, it had just gotten physical and I was really confused. I didn't know what to make of the situation. I called this domestic hotline and the woman on the other end listened to my story and she said, okay, I can't tell you what to do, but what I can tell you is that it is likely to escalate and it would be good for you to consider all of your options. And I was like, what? How can this be? I'm in my early 40s. I'm a professional. I have a law degree. I'm an independent woman. I went so far as to say, I am a second wave feminist. How can I be in this? I was just railing against it because I so didn't want to believe it. And she said something I'll never forget, which was, don't blame yourself. These guys are master manipulators. And she was right. And so I was able to get out. So I just tell that anecdote because I just think it's really important to acknowledge that waking up to the reality of the gender identity industry is very much like waking up to the reality that we are being abused by people who are supposed to love us. And in the end, it's worth it. It's hard psychological work. It really is hard psychological work, but it's totally worth it.
So I would like for you to take off your writer hat for a moment and put on your lawyer hat. And I want you to make a case. I want you to build the case. I guess this is a writer hat too. Build the case. Show the parallels.
Build the case. Show the parallels between domestic abuse and the gender identity industry.
Yes, I want you to – that's your claim. I want you to convince me.
Okay. So first of all, I do want to clarify, and I make this clear in the essay, I am talking primarily about romantic relationships between consenting adults. I think that there are quite, you know, there are different dynamics at play when we're talking about abusive relationships involving adults and children, and I don't claim to know much of anything about that at all. So the parallels that I'm drawing are between the gender identity industry and all of society on the one hand, and abusive relationships between consenting adults on the other. So one way in which I would say they are very similar is the use of control. And I know, having been in an abusive relationship, that my ex was very effective at controlling me psychologically through his use of manipulative tactics. And very clearly we're seeing all of society is in the thralls of this industry. Anyone who's even slightly critical, as you well know, is told that discussion is not permitted, is told that we're hateful. And, you know, many of us have had careers ruined because we have said, what do you mean by gender identity?
So the, or define woman.
Yeah. Yeah.
Or there was a woman at a university in Scotland just last week or so was she's getting in trouble with the university for saying, quote, two things. One is, quote, women have vaginas, end quote, and the other is the average man is stronger than the average woman, and she's getting in big trouble for that.
Right. Yes, this happens all over the world. Yeah, I mean, again, getting back to the whole, like, nobody believes us, what you just said is just astonishing. How can she be in trouble for saying that women have vaginas? Like, how can that be? But it is. It's absolutely true.
And let's pretend for a moment that she's wrong, which she's not, of course. But let's pretend for a moment she's wrong. She would not get in trouble for saying that the Greeks were involved in the Punic Wars. They would just say, no, the Punic Wars were between Carthage and Rome.
Right.
So even if she's wrong, I mean, you're allowed to have wrong opinions all the time, except on this, you're not allowed to have this particular actually correct opinion.
Right. Yes. And that's an example of how I'm making the case about the exercise of control here. It is really astonishing, but here we are. So that's one. Another similarity has to do with separating victims from friends and family. And what I mean by that is we know that in abusive relationships, an abuser will go to great lengths to separate a victim from friends and family, to isolate the victim. And that is very clearly happening here. all of us who have been, you know, standing up for women and girls have lost friends and family. I lost one of my oldest friends because she just got really mad at me and didn't want to talk to me anymore because of this. I haven't lost family yet, but we'll see how that goes. Another one is name calling. Name calling is a hallmark in domestic abusive relationships because it's easier to call someone a name than it is to provide any sort of justification for what the abuser is actually doing. And of course, that's at play here as well when we get called Nazis and TERFs and fascists. Most of us can tell that when we engage, when we attempt to engage in conversation about poking the gender identity industry and its enablers, which we can get into, rather than respond with anything resembling a coherent argument, we get called names all the time. And then, of course, the last one is threats of physical harm. As I said, I spent 10 years, you know, psychologically abused without knowing it. And when it escalated to physical harm, that's when I knew there was a serious problem. And I don't know that men in this fight get threatened with physical harm, but certainly the women do. I list in my essay the example of J.K. Rowling and the I don't even know how many vile, abusive, disgusting threats of violence that she received on social media. And I think to some degree in person, because I remember learning that she had to increase security around her house. And I am pausing to realize that some of your listeners may not know why on earth I'm bringing up J.K. Rowling. Is that
fair? Yeah, go ahead. Always presume that you should give background.
Okay. So J.K. Rowling, of course, author of the Harry Potter series, came out with a tweet in 2019. I don't want to go into the details of what she was supporting there because that would kind of distract us. But basically, she stood up and she said, sex matters. That's basically what she did.
And by the way, she also said, wear whatever you want.
Yeah.
Have sex with whomever you want. Well, whoever will have you.
Yeah.
And have whatever hobbies you want. So she wasn't saying that girls can't play football or that boys can't dance or well or ballet tutus. That's all. She was not saying that at all. She was saying, be whomever you want to be. Well, she wasn't saying that. She was saying, do whatever you want to do that way. But there is a physical category called woman. Am I correct?
Yes. And for that, she was that was on Twitter. And the responses were just absolutely vile. That was in late 2019. And the following year, she wrote a quite beautifully written essay, sort of talking about her experiences, her own experiences as a domestic violence victim, and explaining all of the reasons why it's important to protect sex as a category in law and society. And she also went into a tremendous amount of detail about just the devastating impacts that this industry is having on children, especially gay children. And I know we don't want to get into too much of that, but for anyone who doesn't know, in the United States and in Canada and many other countries, it is possible for minors to be administered hormones that block their puberty, sometimes reverse sex hormones, which cause permanent sterility. And in some places, it's possible for these children to have healthy body parts removed. Mainly, we're talking here about breasts and penises and testicles. And our society is allowing this. And so I just wanted to take a minute to say that that is one of the issues that J.K. Rowling highlighted in her 2020 essay. And it was quite well done and thorough. And she just got an unending amount of abuse and death threats and rape threats in response.
And I just want to highlight that you said casually in passing almost the removal of healthy breasts, penis, and testicles. And I cannot believe that we're even having this discussion, and I cannot believe that we have an entire nation celebrated the essentially televised castration and emasculation of a young boy. This is one of the most horrifying things I have ever even heard of. I write about some horrible things in my books, and this is one of the most horrible.
It's so disgusting. It's just absolutely vile. And in many cases, though not all, in many cases, it is outright homophobia. When these kids are sort of, you know, developing into young adults, developing physically and, you know, in terms of their thoughts and feelings about romantic and sexual attraction, we have documented cases of kids going to their parents and telling their parents that they think they might be gay, and the parents taking them to a clinic and subjecting them to these horrific procedures because they are gay.
I am not a violent person, but had somebody significantly interfered with my ability to have an orgasm when I was a teenager. Well, I shouldn't even bring up violence. I should just say this would be one of the biggest regrets of my life if I had not been able to have. I mean, I'll just say it. Orgasms are one of the most wonderful gifts that nature gives us in the world. I mean, they feel good. I'll just leave it at that. And the notion that, and even dropping off orgasm, the notion of having some sort of full, just messing with somebody's sexuality is really devastatingly scary to me.
Yeah. So that's my case, Derek. How did I do?
Great. And we have not used the word Darvo, because I think that's a Darvo is a central part of all abusive relationships, or most abusive relationships. And I know that almost always the perpetrator of abuse almost never perceives themselves as actually perpetrating abuse. They don't walk into the house and say, I'm going to punch Kara today because I feel like I want to control her. Instead, they have what Robert J. Lifton called a claim to virtue. He talked about that on a larger social scale, which is so often abusers actually perceive themselves as the primary victim, and that will lead us to Darvo. So can you talk about Darvo for a moment?
Yes. I mean, I know the phenomenon. I always forget the actual acronym.
Deny, attack, reverse victim and offender. Deny, attack, reverse victim and offender. So yeah. An example would be, the man did not beat the woman because he's an abuser. The man beat the woman because he worked all day. He got home. She did not have dinner on the table. And when dinner did get on the table, it was this crappy burned steak. She knows that he likes steak rare, but it was burned and overdone after he spent all day working so she can sit around all day long. Blah, blah, blah. You see what I'm getting at, right?
Oh, absolutely. And it's a frequent tactic with proponents of this industry. Anyone who's engaged for any period of time with anyone who's pushing gender identity is very familiar with these tactics. The goalposts constantly move. There's no honesty here. There's no sincere attempt to engage with anything. It's just a complete denial. And the victimhood. Absolutely. You know, we've all been sort of made to believe that there's some sort of marginalized community out there, and that feminists in particular are, you know, responsible for them getting murdered. That's not an exaggeration. People say that all the time. They say that feminists are responsible for quote unquote trans women being murdered. And, you know, I've never killed anyone. I'm just sitting here in my living room. Someone who's sort of well known in this whole debate is a person named Chase Strangio. Chase Strangio is a female person who, quote unquote, identifies as a man and has a very high position at the ACLU. Chase Strangio once took to Twitter to say that I have a, quote, violent vision of trans death. And I'm just sitting there in my pajamas on my sofa or whatever, reading this thinking, what on earth is being said about me here? This is just outrageous. That's just an example.
And what did you actually say that was then twisted into that?
So that tweet came shortly on the heels of a presentation that Women's Liberation Front made before the Heritage Foundation in early 2019. And I was on the panel for that, and part of my bio included the fact that I previously worked at the ACLU, which is 100% true. I worked there from 2012 to 2014. And so my bio included it, because why not? And so in this tweet screed, one of the things that Chase said was that I use my ACLU credentials to prove my left-leaning credibility, and then went on to say that I have a violent vision for trans death.
And the violent vision for trans death is simply saying that women need their own spaces, or I'm having a hard time making the jump from what you are saying. And you and I both agree that the gender identity industry follows an abusive model, but that does not mean that we believe that anyone should do any harm to somebody who identifies as, in fact, we believe that they should not have their genitals cut off.
Right.
I know that I'm fundamentally asking a nonsensical question, because abuse is by definition nonsensical. I mean, even if the woman did burn the stake, that does not logically lead to him punching her in the face.
Right. I mean, the things that I was talking about on that panel were the so-called Equality Act, which is currently before the U.S. Senate, and most feminists think it's really, really bad. And so I was just talking about that. I was talking about the importance of women having women-only spaces, and how the so-called Equality Act would undermine women's ability to have women-only spaces. And yeah, Chase jumped straight to, I have a violent vision for trans death.
Well, And again, that's not unusual. I mean, J.K. Rowling has been accused of being a murderer at this point, and oh my God, they were accusing her of essentially, I'm not saying this, I completely disagree, but they're accusing her of being unsafe around children. She called out her lawyers for that one, I believe.
Yeah.
You know, I've always felt that we should make sure that our claims are defensible, and that we should – I've always felt – here's one of the things that frustrates me about this whole issue, is that I've always felt that if you are hyperbolic, it ultimately undermines your own cause. Mm-hmm. And I'm not seeing that here. They're hyperbolic a lot, and yet it's not seeming to harm them socially. Do you agree?
Yeah, absolutely.
So can you explain that to me? With your essay?
Okay. One of the things I did want to touch on is I have come to understand that there are two levels of gaslighting going on here with this industry. This is an answer to your question. It's just an indirect one. I hope that's okay.
Oh, perfect.
So gaslighting, I came to understand, is basically when an abuser is trying to make the victim think that we're crazy. And back when I was in my psychologically abusive relationship, before I understood that concept or had that word, I referred to it frequently in conversation with my ex as a Twilight Zone moment, because he would say something and then I would say something and then he would contradict himself and I would say, but wait, you just said this other thing. And he would look at me with totally innocent expression and say, I didn't say that. And I would just be standing there like, I know you said that because you just said it a minute ago and I heard it with my own ears, But he really, you know, he tried to manipulate and lie to me and make me think that I was crazy, made me question my own reality. So I say that to say that one of the things that this industry has done is gaslit people into accepting that words like transgender, trans woman, trans man, non-binary have meanings that derive from material reality. Most people, even people who don't want men and women sports, right? Even people who agree with us on that will at least use those words thinking that they mean something or thinking that they're supposed to know what they mean, even if nobody really knows what they mean. And that gets me to the second level of gaslighting that this industry has done, which not only by telling us that those words have meaning, which is not true and makes us all question our sanity, but the industry then went further and said that not only are we all required to believe in the truth of these words, but we're also all required to think that everyone else believes in them too and knows what they mean. So basically, if I'm not me, right, like I'm sort of 7 years into this fight, but if I'm just an average person walking to the store and I read a thing in the newspaper about transgender woman something something, I might think, okay, that doesn't make sense. But if it's on a headline and nobody else is questioning it, I'm not going to want to question it either, because I don't want to look stupid. If everyone knows what that means and I'm the only one who doesn't know what that means, I'm going to keep my mouth shut. And so
that's, especially if you're going to get death threats if you don't.
But even someone who doesn't know about the death threats, even someone who doesn't know about J.K. Rowling, just a regular average person seeing a headline that says, you know, trans woman murdered something, something, a regular person is probably going to think, trans woman, what the heck does that mean? But if everyone else is accepting it, then I'm going to start to think, okay, I guess everyone else knows what it means and I'm the only one who doesn't.
Do you know about the ASH experiment?
No.
Oh, this is so cool. I don't know, 60s, 70s. They would have five people come in and – or four people, however many – come in and look at a series of lines, one of which would be obviously shorter than others. Others might be longer. And then they would say which of these lines is the shortest or which is the longest. And only one person was actually being experimented on. Everybody else was an actor. Mm-hmm. And the actors would give the wrong answer. Oh, the one on the right is the longest one, when obviously it's not. And what happened pretty consistently is the first couple times that this would happen, the person who was the actual subject of the experiment would go, no, the short one is the one in the middle. The one on the right is not the short one. And the third or fourth time through, you could see that they're just really confused, but they would go, no, the one on the right is the short one. And yeah, it's exactly what you're talking about.
Yeah. So I'm not remembering exactly why I thought that would be a helpful answer to your question or what your question was.
I think the whole thing is – I think it was really great, because it is helping us understand how the thing is such a brain buster, because it's just so obvious that you know, men are generally better at most sports, not all, and there are reasons for sex segregation, and – yet we're continually told that there are not. And then can you talk a little bit about enablers? We have like, 6 or 7 minutes left, and I want to ask a wind down in a couple of minutes. But before we go there, can you talk about enablers?
Yeah, so I cover a little bit of this in my piece, talking about how, like all narcissistic abusers, the gender identity industry has its enablers. And here I'm thinking probably most glaringly of government actors who are just sneaking gender identity into the law in a way that will have devastating effects for women and girls regularly. This is happening at the federal level. It's happening it's happening both in the executive branch and in the legislative branch. It's also happening in the courts at the federal level. It's happening throughout the state, the states at the state level and at the local level. So it's really the government, our elected officials are really doing the work of the gender identity industry by enacting laws that essentially erase women and girls. So that's kind of the biggest one. But also, we also need to understand here that I think at this point, and I'm open to being wrong about this, I think at this point that literally every institution of our civil society has allowed itself to become completely captured by this dangerous, abusive, manipulative, narcissistic lie. And in that, I include the media, academia, of course, corporations. You can't walk down the aisle at Safeway without seeing some kind of rainbow branded product these days. Nike's getting in the game. Anyway, civic institutions such as the ACLU, all of these institutions have allowed themselves to be completely captured. I refer to them as apaths. This is a word that is often used to describe a category of an enabler. These institutions may or may not themselves be narcissistic. I don't want to opine on that. But at a minimum, they clearly do not care at all about the consequences of their actions. They have no empathy for those of us who are being impacted by this. Corporations just want to make money, right? Academia just wants to peddle its queer theory nonsense. I know we don't have time to get started on that, but these institutions have all allowed themselves to become completely captured, and they are lying to us. They are doing the dirty work of the main abuser, which is the industry itself. And then finally, just very briefly to hit on what I learned are called archetypal empaths. So these are people, including many women, who seem to honestly believe that they're doing the right thing. They seem to honestly believe this, and they seem to kind of naively assume that the industry could not possibly be a narcissistic abuser, because that would be counter to their underlying worldview, which is that at the end of the day, things are basically harmonious. And so the idea that this is actually a narcissistic abusive industry runs counter to that, their own narrative. And so they don't want to believe it. So they end up doing the dirty work of the abuser as well. So that's how I've kind of broken down what I've come to view as this industry's enablers.
Which, by the way, is also something that happens constantly in domestic violence situations too. You know, there were so many people who my mom would turn to them to try to get some help to get out, and they would end up enabling the abusers. This included marriage counselors. It included preachers. It included family members. There's a terrible, terrible problem in this culture of identifying with the abuser, which is a whole nother topic that we don't really have time for.
Right.
So we have just a couple minutes left, and one of the things, there's a line by R.D. Lang that I just love, which is, how do you plug a void plugging a void? And what he means by that, or what he meant by that, was if you have some sort of psychological need that you are filling with, if you have a psychological hole that you are not filling through dealing with the primary trauma or primary issue, but instead filling with an addiction. So if somebody has deep woundedness and they are trying to fill that by controlling another person, or they're trying to fill it with heroin, or they're trying to fill it with television or with consumption, they will, or with sex, or if you're trying to fill it with something else, because you're not fulfilling that you're not really filling the hole. And so you can't plug that void ever, which means your demands will be insatiable, which is why abusers escalate. One of the reasons abusers escalate is that they're trying to fill a hole in themselves, and they're trying to do it by controlling another person, but that can never be sufficient because they always need to keep violating more and more boundaries because it never suffices. And so my point on this is that something that I see in this movement, and also I see in any abusive movement, is that its demands are insatiable.
Absolutely. Absolutely. There's a great piece that a British feminist wrote. It's called something like Annals of the Turf Wars or something like that. I could find it if that would be helpful. And it sort of starts out maybe 10 years ago and starts out where, you know, people were sort of saying like, oh, you know, everybody needs human rights. And feminists were like, okay, that sounds good. And then, you know, people were like, well, we just need to pee. And feminists were like, you know, okay, why don't you go take that third space over there to pee? We don't care. And it just ramped up over the last several years. I know this has been going on sort of behind the scenes for decades now, but the speed and the force and the ferocity with which it has taken over in the past 10 years or so is just astounding. And you're right, it's insatiable. They won't stop.
Okay, so last question. What do we do? Those of us who care about discourse, those of us who care about women's spaces, those of us who care about material reality. And I just want to point out one more thing, too, which is that if you ask someone to define, please define, you're going to pass a law, so please define gender identity or please define woman, either one, instead of actually defining those, which it blows me away that they pass laws with no definitions, instead of defining those, they simply, to go back to what you were saying earlier, call you a Nazi and threaten to kill you.
Yeah.
And so those of us who care about even just discourse, what do we do? How do we stop this abusive, narcissistic abusive juggernaut?
So I think a couple things, and I'll just give a couple examples of how I think this can be effective. I was recently meeting with a civic women's group, right? This happens to be a Republican women's group in a major American city. First of all, Republicans are often just astonished to know that there are people who sort of think of themselves as left of center who are critical of this. And so it's good for them to know. But anyway, one of the women asked me, okay, Kara, what are we going to do about the issue of transgender athletes competing in women's sports? And I said, well, I've got some advocacy ideas, but first, let's just take a step back. What do you mean by transgender? I'm saying, don't parrot to me what you think the accepted definition is. Literally, what do you have in your mind when you use that word? And there was a pause, and her response was, well, I thought I had to use that word. And I said, okay, fair enough. By that, do you mean men and boys competing in women's and girls' sports? And she said, well, yes. And I said, great. You can just say that. And she said, I didn't think I was allowed to say that. And I said, well, take it from me. Like, trust me, you're allowed to say what you mean. If you mean men and boys, it's perfectly fine to say men and boys. And I swear the room breathed a collective sigh of relief at little old me just giving them permission to use precise language. So that, I think, was effective. And another example I'll just give is I was having a one-on-one conversation with a friend who's a very smart woman. She's very intelligent. She's a critical thinker. She's an attorney. And she said to me, Kara, what's your beef with the transgender issue? Why is this such a big deal for you? And I said, okay, well, what do you mean by transgender? And she paused and she said, I guess people who are trans. And I said, okay, what do you mean by that? And she was like, I guess I don't really know. And I said, all right, fair enough. I know that you are an intelligent person and you do not use words when you do not know their meanings. And she's like, yeah. So I said, why are you doing it here? And she kind of nervously giggled and said, I guess I don't know why I'm doing it here. But of course we know. But I guess the point is I sort of made her think. And I really want all of us who care about discourse, who care about integrity, who care about women's spaces, to stop using the language of the oppressor, to free ourselves to simply state what we mean. It's just as liberating to free ourselves to speak truth and say what we mean as it is to get away from a guy who is starting to physically abuse me.
Well, thank you. Thank you so much for that. And thank you for your work in the world. And I would like to thank listeners for listening. My guest today has been Kara Danske. This is Derek Jensen for Resistance Radio on the Progressive Radio Network.